This is Vermont Edition. I'm Michaela LaFrac. Farms across our region are still recovering from last year's summer floods. A warmer winter and changes to the soil environment have made it even more difficult for farmers to recover from natural disasters, which are becoming more frequent due to climate change. Today's show is part of our week of coverage around the anniversary of the 2023 summer floods. We're focusing today on farming and agriculture. We'll check in with some of the farmers who we spoke to last year on Vermont Edition right after the flooding. We'll also talk about how farmers and ag specialists are prepping for the future. Now, recently, I visited the Innervale Center in Burlington. The six farms there were submerged underwater last year during the floods. Patrick Dunseith is the land manager, and he walked me around.
Nobody was really expecting an Irene-level storm. Yeah. And it's kind of like, oh, no, that's the 100-year storm. That's not going to happen again. And then we kept watching the forecasting and everything ratchet up to the point where we're like, oh, wow, this is going to be on that scale. I started, like, moving equipment from our equipment barn, yeah. Just getting, like, the most sensitive stuff onto, like, a foot higher ground.
Cause what down kind of here,
stuff? Tractor implements, anything, you know, with a motor on it. You know, down here, it's like a few inches make a big difference. Yeah. This is the ag complex, so all our kind of just tractors, equipment, coolers, everything. Our shop is in this barn here. And, you know, in Irene, this whole area stayed pretty much dry. Last year was a little bit of an unlearning for farms here that, like, oh, yeah, it does get worse than Irene. That can happen. We're trying to be, better prepared, you know, and how do we keep that preparedness just alive as part of our culture down here?
There's already so much uncertainty in farming. It must be hard to, wrap your mind around adding even more in.
It's amazing what farmers have to hold, right? It's what draws so many people to it is that you have to do it all, right? You have to be a scientist, a mathematician, a poet, right? Mm-hmm. Like, you have to be all of these amazing things. You have to be a mechanic. And at the end of the day, you also have to be, like, an educator, right? And yeah, I think that's what the flood brings up.
That was Patrick Dunseith, the land manager at the Innervale Center in Burlington. We have two guests joining us today for the full hour. Heather Darby is an agronomist and soil specialist for the University of Vermont Extension. I believe we're getting her on a new line right now. Heather, I hope you're with us. Are you there?
I'm here.
All right, great. Thanks so much for joining us. We are also joined in the studio today by Grace Odell. She's the executive director of the Northeast Organic Farming Association of Vermont, or NOFA. It's a nonprofit that supports organic farms. Grace, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Oh, Heather, I'm hoping you could kick us off by helping us to put last year's floods into perspective. Now, often some of, the most fertile soil is on floodplains, and farmers are very used to managing risk and dealing with all sorts of different environmental changes. But how different was 2023?
Yeah, very, very different. Farmers that farm river bottom are used to, dealing with kind of yearly flood events that come at very specific times of the year, maybe early in the spring or late, into the fall. And I don't want to say predictable necessarily, but definitely not in July, right in the sort of midst of the growing season when the crops were just about ready to harvest for a lot of vegetable producers or things they were harvesting, and also at a very extreme level. So it was, flooding plus more flooding, and then more rain too. So definitely very different for the farmers on the river bottom. Mm.
And Grace, NOFA has members all across the state, organic farmers across Vermont. Right before the show, you were saying that you and your team have been doing a lot of reflecting at this time of the year, on this one-year anniversary. What are some of the things that have been top of mind for you as we hit this anniversary?
Well, I think, like you heard Patrick's ask at the beginning of the show, we're wondering, is this a 100-year flood? Is this a 10-year flood? Is this an every other year flood? And how do we both adapt and become resilient in the face of a changing climate? How do we keep farming and growing food that will allow our farms to remain viable, allow us to be truly climate resilient, and allow Vermonters to have true food security long term? So one of the things we've been reflecting on, honestly, is the strength of our community here in the state. When there was a really not enough quick federal support, community organizations, individual people, neighbors, and our state were able to step up and show up for each other. And that was really amazing to witness.
Yeah. Heather, you're a farmer yourself. Was your land affected by the flooding? And what types of community support did you witness in your own area?
Yeah. So I think the farms that were flooded had, you know, substantial damage during that one immense event. But every farm across our state suffered from the extreme, you know, wet weather that we received last year. So, you know, some farms receiving 60 inches of precipitation. So every farm was impacted quite significantly by the, you know, large amount of rain that we received. Our farm in particular, we're not in an area that would receive flooding. We're in the Lake Champlain Islands, but just the wet weather constant and no drying out, you know, just had a real heavy, heavy impact on the farm.
Hmm. Well, Grace, we had you on Vermont Edition right after the floods hit, and NOFA was offering these emergency grants for farmers. You also on the show brought up all these different funding options that were becoming more clear every single day that were available for farmers. First, how many grants or how much grant funding in total did NOFA end up giving out?
Yeah, so for a little bit of context, after Irene, we gave out a little over $200,000 in emergency grants. That's really quick cash to help folks make it through. So initially, we were thinking might be in that range, and it continued both in need and in contribution to grow and grow really rapidly. We ended up giving about $1.6 to $1.7 million out through the fund. Wow. That was largely raised through generous donations, community partners, folks stood up their own fundraisers to contribute. And because there was really no meaningful program that was otherwise providing support in a really quick way, we made the decision, our Farmer Emergency Fund Committee, which is governed by farmers themselves, decided to open that fund to any farm who wanted to join at that point, whether you were certified organic or not, to try to help everyone we could. And we gave out these grants to over 200 farms to help them in these early moments before there was a clearer picture. And we did really help in that short-term period. We were able to turn checks around from the time of application to getting a check out the door in about 7 to 8 days on average. And that, I just point to that because speed is really, really important, especially at that moment in the season when a lot of folks had a lot of money out already. They had taken on loans to buy seed and buy inputs for their farm, and you're banking on a harvest later in the season. And that harvest, because as Heather said, this flood came at such a poor time in this growing season, just didn't happen for a lot of farms. So many of our farms here in Vermont did not have crop insurance at all. 70%, according to the agency's own estimation, did not have crop insurance. And of the people who did have crop insurance, most of those programs are designed with very consolidated large-scale agriculture in mind, commodity growing, that really doesn't support the types of farms that we have here. So we helped a number of farms through arduous, lengthy applications that ultimately didn't really pan out for help for them. So or not much help. So we are working to improve those and push, and Senator Welch has introduced the Weather Act to try to look at improving those programs long term. And we hope that they can be improved and we can learn together about how to make those programs better. The state also was able to stand up an emergency fund out of their $20 million fund for businesses who were affected by flooding. They made some donation some grant programs mm-hmm. available through that that were several million dollars. And Vermont Community Foundation also opened up a portal for farmers to be able to access more significant resources. So those did come. And again, that community and state scale, there was really significant support that ended up coming and helping farmers make it through. And that's really critical learning from this, that level is where we really were able to keep each other safe.
Yeah. And Grace, you mentioned that many, many farmers do not have crop insurance. That might be something that people outside of the world of agriculture don't realize. Heather, I'm wondering if you could help explain why that is, why crop insurance is often not accessible or affordable for many farmers.
Yeah, well, one of the predominant crops in the state, which is hay and pasture, really is, you know, considered low value and also generally just it's not insured or insurable in many cases. So there's a large acreages of land for livestock owners in particular that goes uninsured, you know, for that reason. As Grace mentioned, a lot of smaller specialty crop farmers, it's very expensive or even difficult, especially to get enrolled in some of the government insurance programs. Oftentimes they cost more and don't pay out as much as your crops, even worse. I remember our own farm paying insurance on strawberries. We have a very small farm too, and I remember 1 year needing to collect on it, and we got back less than we lost, and less than we paid in. So we had been paying this premium and just didn't even get a return on it. So the system isn't set up for every crop, every scale of farmer. And then again, the cost can be very prohibitive as mm-hmm. well for so many people.
And that's part of the reason why last summer after the flooding, we saw so many online donations coming through. Lots of GoFundMes were being set up for specific farms and farm stands. Let's talk about that model for a moment here. I want to play another clip from Patrick Dunseith, the land manager at the Intervale Center.
The CSA model is so powerful, you know, in helping consumers buy into the risk of farming. But ultimately, right, what we saw in response last year was a lot of GoFundMes, right? When you see people using GoFundMe to cover their medical bills, right, it's a sign that the healthcare system's broken, right? And when you see farmers using GoFundMes to recover from a flood, we're not truly valuing those resources.
Grace, what do you think of Patrick's point there?
Yeah, I agree with Patrick's point. I mean, I think on the one hand, the GoFundMes show that the community really does want to see these small-scale Vermont farms that we know and love survive. And I think he's absolutely spot on that if farmers have to stand up GoFundMes to make it through a climate event like this, that's a sign that the systems that should be in place to support them, the policies that should be in place and the structures should be valuing them all the time, haven't. And one of the things we've been thinking about a lot is how can we tether the learnings that we've had over the last, let's expand it out to maybe 4 years, from COVID through the flooding last year, to really think holistically about what resilience can look like. So for me, I think back to COVID and I think about those bare grocery store shelves and how so many local Vermont farmers quickly stood up distribution systems and ways to share, you know, distribution trucking and bring each other's products to people's homes because they were in the community and they knew the community and they wanted to figure out a way to keep people fed in that really challenging time when corporate agribusiness and really, really brittle supply chains couldn't. And then last year's climate event, when we had this major disruption, you know, we need to start connecting these dots between climate resilience, farm viability, and food security for the state. If we want to have a Vermont future where we have small-scale farms that can survive, we need to do exactly what Patrick is saying and design policy that really supports those folks in a really economically impossible time when it's just really hard to stay small and to stay Vermont scale and to tend land the ways that most of our farmers really want to tend their land and are tending their land to keep a healthy working landscape, making clean water and sequestering carbon in the soil and keeping communities fed. That's going to take us making policies that really enable that, because just letting sort of the federal systems do what they are right now is promoting corporate consolidation, growth in very few companies, and not really thinking holistically about this climate resilience and food security partnership between those two goals.
Mm-hmm. Now, over at the Innervale Community Farm in Burlington, Andy Jones manages the farm and their 600-member CSA. Recently, he and I sat down together near one of their fields as he reflected on the floods.
So where we are right now would have been, as we're sitting, like chest deep, maybe neck deep. It's really hard to imagine that the whole thing is going to be a lake. You know, you could just see people's flowers floating up, their watermelon bobbing underneath, you know, the squash tendrils like reaching up underwater.
Have you gained a newfound respect for any specific plant or crop that you just saw persevere through those terrible conditions, or something that everybody could just kind of like fall back on and be like, oh, thank God for the tomatoes in the tunnels? Or
I really appreciated cool weather crops because we were able to replant stuff late July, August, you know, really fairly late in the season, and still have some really beautiful cabbage family, root vegetables, green leafy greens and things like that, well into, you know, mid-November. So there were some things that I was pretty surprised about. Our eggplant crop was completely underwater, and yet we ended up getting eggplant off of it later. They struggled for a long time, and then finally, like, oh, we've got eggplant in September. So it was a bit of a surprise.
Well, as many farmers in this region know, after the flooding, farmers were directed to throw out all their crops due to contamination from the floodwaters. Heather, how are the soils doing now? Does it really depend on where you live?
Yeah, it really depends on where you live, you know, the amount of flooding you received, exactly like what, how long it was underwater, where it was located along the river. But overall, you know, I think that what's always surprising to myself and many others and the farmers too is how resilient our soils are. And one of the farmers I work with along the Winooski actually had me come out, and he was really concerned about the soil biology. That was his primary concern. He was wondering what happened to all of his worms, and, you know, we started digging around, and we started to see life, and he got really excited, and the following days, he kept sending me photos of, you know, worms and worm castings, and really excited about the soil starting to come back and repair itself. But it does take a little extra work, too. You know, one of the recommendations that we had for farmers was to get something growing as soon as they could, to get roots down in the ground, start to sort of aerate the soil and bring some of the biology back. Unfortunately, it stayed wet so long after the flooding that was really, really hard for people to do, almost impossible in many cases. But everybody worked to try to bring life back to the soil, you know, the best that they could as soon as they could. But the damage and the reconditioning, really, you can, you know, it's still something we have to keep working on even a year later. Mm. You can still see.
Well, let's bring a couple more farmers into this conversation. We're joined now by David Marchand, who co-owns Riverberry Farm in Fairfax. They grow vegetables, strawberries, raspberries, flowers, and much more. And last year, they had about 8 feet of water in their fields, destroying between half and three quarters of their crops. David, thanks for coming on.
Yeah.
Can you tell us a little bit more about what happened last year, especially in the later part of the season? Were you able to recover?
Oh yeah, we have a lot of upland. It doesn't flood, and that was all in cover crops. So we quickly pivoted and had all these transplants that were ready to go in the lower fields, and we just started plowing in, tilling in cover crops, and so we planted up in our upper lands and went actually quite well. So from all those crops, did very well.
Oh, that's good to hear. And what was the economic hit like? Was it something that you know had a short term impact, or is that something you're still feeling as we head into this season?
I would say more of a short term, impact, and it probably was all the community support between Vermont Community Fund, the BGAP, the state support, and then federal. We had a lot of federal help with the repairs of, because we had a lot of erosion, so.
Yeah.
So that certainly helped a lot.
And have you made any changes to your farm, your land, your business since last year's flooding, or is it business as usual this year?
We've taken out where the erosion happened. We ended up doing a lot of tree planting with the help of our conservation district and the Northwest Conservation District in Franklin County. And so areas where that had erosion, where it broke banks that it really never had before, are now in small trees, and hopefully this week won't do it again, so they can get through a year or two and then hopefully hold, so won't lose the soil like we did.
Yeah, we're expecting more rain this week. Well, David Marchand, who owns Riverberry Farm in Fairfax, thanks so much for taking some time out of your day today.
You're welcome.
We also have on the line Bruce Hennessy, the co-owner of Maplewind Farm in Richmond. They raise grass-fed beef and pasture-raised poultry, pork, and eggs. And last November, my colleague Howard Weiss-Tisman reported on how Bruce and his staff saved hundreds of turkeys during the flood. Bruce, welcome.
Thanks for having me on.
For folks who didn't hear Howard's story, can you tell us a little bit about the efforts you had to go to save these turkeys on your farm?
Well, we spent the entire day before the event, or as the event was coming in, moving thousands of birds out of the lower part of our farm fields that we knew would be inundated. Unfortunately, we, reading forecast, we thought we were safe having our turkeys up on a high part of our fields. And turns out that forecast was incorrect, and we were early the following morning, we were inundated. I made the poor decision to try to drive my tractor in with a stock trailer to get to the turkeys. Unfortunately, the entry to the field was 7 or 8 feet lower than the, or even further lower than the high point in that field, and the tractor was not able to make that journey. So we pivoted to getting canoes out and trying to go in and save the turkeys that way, and. It wasn't hundreds that we were able to save. We saved about 120 turkeys out of 500 on that land. Yep.
Oh. What did that feel like? I mean, you care for these animals year round and put so much effort into keeping them healthy and happy. To sustain that level of loss so quickly must have been heartbreaking.
Yes, it definitely is heartbreaking. In the moment, you're just trying to see what you can do to mitigate the damage and try to save them as best you can. Okay. You know, the difficult thing for us is that we were pretty confident based on the forecast that we received that the waters were going to start to recede when we went to bed that night. And instead, it went actually 8 feet higher than forecasted in that field. And that was the really difficult part of that. And even, you know, in responding, the birds weren't even inundated yet when we responded, but the fact that we couldn't get there was a devastating part of what happened that morning. And then it was actually one of my staff that had the idea to get the canoes out and just do what we could instead of sitting there and watching them perish. So, you know, the truth is that turkeys can and do swim, but they don't handle the temperature of the water well at all. So it was really hypothermia that was knocking them out, and then they wouldn't be able to stay afloat. So it was we did get all the birds that were still kicking out there into the canoes before we were done.
Oh, it's heartbreaking. In the wake of what happened last year, what types of support were most helpful, most beneficial to you?
Well, first of all, I mean, we don't exist. You know, we've been in business for over 25 years, and it's all because of our community. Without that. So we had a tremendous amount of outpouring of support just from our local community and customers and people just coming out and buying our products. And then, of course, the state came out with a number of different grant programs. NOFA Vermont had an emergency program that they had emergency funds to us nearly immediately, within just a few days of the incident. And, you know, so all of those grant programs were amazing, and also just private donations and expressions of support, just, not only through, you know, just people coming in and, talking with us and expressing support, but also, using their food dollars to express support as well. It was a tremendous outpouring of support, as it has been in kind of all the times when we're down, and even when we're not, we have a tremendous amount of support. So,
well, Bruce, I hope this season goes much more smoothly for you and the animals there. Bruce Hennessy is the co-owner of Maple Wind Farm in Richmond. Thanks so much for calling in today.
Hey, you bet. Happy to do so.
Grace O'Dell with NOFA, I saw you taking some notes while our two farmers from different parts of the state were speaking. What are your thoughts hearing what they said?
Well, I'm so glad that both Bruce and David are still at it and still doing what they're doing. And one of the themes I'm really hearing is this strong commitment to doing climate resilience planning. They're putting in trees. They're remapping out where they're going to have their animals. They're really thinking about how to be resilient in the face of a really unpredictable climate future. And that is what our farmers here are so good at doing, is that scrappy planning, getting back on their feet, figuring out how to make it work, figuring out how to keep the soil stable for everyone. We're all really supported by that work. And one of the things I just want to underscore is what Bruce was just saying, that one way to help long term is to really think about the ways that we spend our money in the regular times as an opportunity to invest in a climate secure future. Now, not everyone has the opportunity to really feel like they have any flexibility in their food budget, and that's totally understandable. But I do want to point to one really successful and hopeful thing that happened this past legislative session, was that Vermont chose to invest in food access programs, that including programs like FarmShare, which is a program that both supports limited income eaters and directly supports Vermont's small-scale farmers, who we want to support to stay in business. And this points back to what Patrick was saying earlier. What are the programs and policies we need to put in place now as a state that cares about our future, so that these farmers are not taking all this risk and all this loss on their own backs? Because we really need them for our own climate health, for our own food security, to be able to remain in business. So whether it's a personal decision we can make to really think about investing in our local producers, in our neighborhoods, and in our communities with our food dollars, or bring our policy voice to ask our state to do so through programs like FarmShare that supports both limited income Vermonters and our farmers. Like, those feel really important steps to take, because I used to farm in Northern California, where we were constantly living under the risk of fire. And we saw that after the first fire, there was a lot of community support. And after the second fire, there was still community support, but everyone was really taxed and stressed. And after the third fire, a lot of folks closed up shop, right? And the farm that actually that I was tending with my partner ended up being burned. And people come back and replant and try again. But what has really changed is policies that actually go to support farmers in coming back, local and regional and state policies that help farmers do that. And that's met with this generosity of the earth that Heather was describing with the earthworms coming back, which is if we can find ways to take one step of care and do a little bit more to plant those trees and aerate the soil and put the love there, the earth is so willing to be resilient and adaptable and meet us and give back. And so I really think we can keep coming back from these events if we invest properly.
Hmm. And Heather, as you're listening to Grace here, I'm curious if there are any policies or programs that you, from a agronomist perspective, a farmer's perspective, have seen pass recently or know are on the table right now that you think could help make these types of changes?
Yeah, there is, a large and I guess very significant push on the federal government side through the Natural Resource Conservation Service, through the USDA, for climate resiliency. And there's millions of dollars moving throughout the U.S. to every state in the country to help farmers build resiliency through a wide, wide variety of practices. Those programs are open to all farms, and the types of practices that are being promoted and funded aren't necessarily all that different from things that we're already doing, but some of them are. And so that's really exciting and a really exciting opportunity for a lot of farmers to tap into over the next number of years as those programs start to kick off. So some of those programs even allow to purchase renewable energy equipment, as an example. So there are some really new initiatives coming out from the federal government as well. So that's really exciting and will be really helpful to the farms in Vermont.
We put a call out on Instagram ahead of today's show for questions or comments about farming and agriculture in the wake of the floods. We got this response from Daniel. He says, I have a 4-plus-acre lower field that is no longer viable for agriculture. Heather, have you heard from farmers who are in a similar situation?
Yeah. I mean, definitely there are, many fields and in some cases some farms that I don't want to say have abandoned land necessarily, but have had to leave places that they were farming because of significant damage. And I'm thinking of one actually right outside of Hardwick as an example that was so badly damaged last year during the flood that the farm has stopped utilizing that piece of land. There was so much silt, feet and feet of silt over the top of this beautiful hay meadow, trees, debris, parts of the hotel that floated away, just something that felt really unsurmountable for that particular farm to really sort of recover and get back using it. So it does happen, and in some cases, the state or federal government does kind of step in and help, I don't want to say conserve some of that land, but help sort of protect it and allow it to become a place where, floodwaters can go and it not become farmland anymore.
Mm. And Grace, can you tell us how many members NOFA has, and have any of them had to either close off large portions of their land due to the flooding or had to close entirely?
Yeah. We have about 1,100 members, and we've only heard from a couple who have decided to not continue after the floods. We just sent out over the last couple of months, we did a lot of outreach to all of the farms that had received emergency funding to ask how they were doing and just follow up, you know, what they're planning for and what their season's looking like. And we did hear from a couple that the flooding was just too much on top of an already stressful situation. But overwhelmingly, the farms are continuing and folks are trying. And as Heather said, you know, deciding to use different pieces of land or to do things differently, but are really trying to move forward. These are folks who really want to continue providing food for this community. And that feels really heartening that people are resilient, land is resilient. And when the community comes together, we're able to find a way through some really, really challenging times. Mm.
Well, you know, as we hit this 1 year anniversary, we are expecting more rain this week, and there's been some flash flood warnings, so hopefully nothing to the extent of last year. Heather, could you tell us a little bit about what the season has been like so far?
Well, everyone is different. I will say that, and It has been for many, it has been a difficult season already. Hmm. We've had, you know, we started off a bit dry and cool, but it has actually been really wet. And it has been really difficult for people to, again, kind of get things done, get crops in the ground, get normal sort of farming practices done, from cultivating to mowing hay on time. So it continues to be stressful. So we didn't go from, you know, like beyond stressful year last year into a stellar cropping season as of yet. It's also been really warm so far over the last couple of months, these kind of warm spurts that are extreme, you know, where we're hitting 90, close to 100 degrees in June after having, you know, very cool weather. It stresses the crops out, you know, and causes quite a bit of damage in some crops when it gets that hot. So we're seeing a lot of fluctuations, a lot of erratic weather, heavy rainstorms, wet soils. So it has continued to be stressful. And I know, you know, there is sort of this eternal optimism in farming where, you know, you always think, well, it'll be better next year. And I think that's sometimes, I guess, what keeps us all going. But it is, you know, we haven't talked about the sort of mental stress and the mental health of the people, all of us that have gone through this last year and, you know, just climate change in general and all that stress on the farm, you know, it builds up over time. And that's something that can become really, you know, overwhelming for people to deal with.
Is that something you've felt yourself, Heather?
Yeah, I think so. I think we all do, even in my work life, you know, as an extension agronomist, you know, you're on your own farm feeling the weight and the stress of all the rain and watching the crops and just wondering what you're going to do. And then going out across the state and feeling that weight of everyone else's stress as well, you know, and trying to help people overcome this. And, you know, I laugh a little bit about this story, but during Irene, we helped some farms over in the Rochester area, and I specifically remember one of my colleagues coming with me and bringing chocolate and rubber boots and ice cream or something like that, and how grateful people were for these snacks, this chocolate. And so I decided when I went out to visit farms after the floods that I was going to bring these snacks, these gift baskets, which seems sort of silly, but as I, you know, brought them to people and just checked in on people, you know, I couldn't save their crops, but I was there for them, you know, like everybody's talking about the community, and I brought them, you know, the small things to enjoy, you know, some maple popcorn. And I remember one of the farms I visited saying, oh, I'm going to enjoy this tonight, watching the Red Sox game. But, you know, so I think just helping people through these really hard times mentally, you know, the physical part of farming isn't really the hard part, actually. You know, it's all the stress from weather, really, a lot of the times, that can become overwhelming for people.
Mm. Thank you for sharing that. And Grace, I'm sure you've heard many similar stories over the past year and before that, too. What mental health supports are you aware of that farmers, people working in agriculture, can access?
Yeah, Farm First provides mental health support for farmers who are experiencing mental health stress. And that's also something that we have been trying to scale up. As Heather said, as service providers and as folks talking to a lot of farmers, that is a really repeat need that we hear. So please do reach out to a service provider or to Farm First, and we can help get you connected if that's something. But I think Heather's, how lucky are we to have Heather in our state doing the work that she's doing and being the person who so many farmers have come in to visit.
She's hand-delivering popcorn.
She's hand-delivering popcorn. Better than that. Exactly. I really do think, though, that the being together, the sharing food together, the finding ways to resource ourselves with connection and with joy, one of the things that's happening also is a lot of these farms are geographically disparate and isolated. And so that is another layer of added stress on top. And we need to do what we can to really tend those moments of connection, to resource ourselves for just a lot of change and disruption that's coming our way, whether we want it or not. And at the same time, insist on accessing the supports that are available. As Heather mentioned, there is currently a lot of federal money, if we can get at it and get our farmers to get at it, to do climate resilience practices. And insist on policies that really can help support these folks who we need so desperately for a thriving future, our farmers and farm workers who are continuing to produce the food that will keep us all fed and the land healthy. So I think it's both and. We need to bring the chocolate bars, literally bring chocolate bars. That was also something that we were really seeing people do and doing, is watching, you know, elderly CSA members show up to the CSA when folks were cleaning out with warm plates of cookies that were then feeding the volunteers doing this like cleanup of silt. And we need those kinds of really human interactions. And we also need to build power across all of us who do farming and farm work to raise our voice and say, we're the folks tending the land and keeping communities fed. And we really need to be real about what we're facing here.
Hmm. Well, Heather, I'm also hoping you can add one more takeaway, perhaps for folks who are not working in agriculture. One thing that people could do listening to today's show, when they turn off their radio or smart speaker, to support a farmer in their region or the broader agricultural economy.
One thing. Well, let's see. I think Grace has already said, and many of the farmers, just, you know, go out and support them, buy their products. I think something else that's really important is understand more about farming. There's not a lot of farmers anymore, and there's definitely less of a connection to what it takes to farm, what people are doing when they're out there, and really understanding what farming is all about. And just doing that and being open to what you're seeing and understanding it and being supportive and asking questions before judgment is really, really critical, because we need all of our farmers in the state. We actually need more farmers in our state. And the more that we can support that and understand, and again, you know, not be there to judge, but to be there to learn and understand what farming is all about, is really important to supporting the community beyond just going to buy those products.
Hmm. And Grace, where can people go to learn more about NOFA and your work?
Yeah, you can go to NOFA, NOFAVT.org.
All right. Quick and easy. Well, Grace Odell with NOFA VT, thank you so much for joining us. We really appreciate your time.
Thanks for having me.
We're also joined today by Heather Darby with UVM Extension and a farmer herself. Heather, thank you for joining us. Even though you were feeling under the weather, we really appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you.